This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello, welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week we have reports on two islands off the coast of Cape Breton where seamen have claimed one disappears into the water and the other fades into thick fog. A murder suspect garners an angry crowd at the Sydney courthouse. If you like kickflips, there's a rad group putting wheels in motion for you, and a local hockey team hopes some scammers will soon be in the sin bin. These stories are coming up on the coast. Tensions were high at a Sydney courthouse where a murder suspect was granted one of the highest bail postings in the province's history. The Coast 89.7's Jacob Postlewaite reports.
49-year-old Christopher Anderson Neville is charged with first-degree murder in connection to the death of 44-year-old Jeff Pearson of Whitney Pier. Pearson died in a shooting at a home on Shore Road in Whitney Pier early on the morning of February 22nd. Shortly after his death, three Alberta men, 27-year-old Mal Chol, 19-year-old Letcher Gang, and 20-year-old Goner Mark Tutt were all charged with first-degree murder in relation to his death. Neville was later arrested on the same charge in Halifax. When proceedings began, Crown Attorney Peter Dostal said they had reached an agreement with Neville's lawyers on release order conditions, which was agreed to by Supreme Court Justice Shane Russell. Neville was granted bail for $630,000 coming from himself and three sureties. Speaking to reporters, Dostal outlined the long list of conditions that Neville will face upon his release.
It's strict house arrest. He is to stay in his house 24/7. There are security cameras around the house to entries and exits that are accessible to the police. He has a GPS monitor that monitors every few seconds as to his exact location. That information is accessible to the police. His communications on social media are prohibited. He has three individuals who are expected to be responsible to police him 24 hours a day. And if they fail or are negligent in their duties, they have significant financial penalties in relation to that. He will be limited on what phone calls he can make. He can be limited on what form of access to the internet they will be. He will not be going anywhere, and he will be expected to remain there for the duration of his proceedings.
Neville is also required to turn in his passport and is banned from airports, heliports, and ferry terminals. The news of Neville's bail posting was largely met with anger from those attending the day's proceedings, many of whom were family and friends of Pearson. Justice Russell began the proceedings by warning the public not to interrupt them. Towards the end of the day, Russell had one member of the public removed from the courtroom, which led to a large number of people choosing to express their anger at the decision as they left. Outside the courtroom, tensions were very high.
The public wants their say.
We got it all documented. We already get it on paper. Yep. All that's the case.
This is the son. We don't want that kind of public. Don't want him released, and we want our say.
Shame.
Many stayed at the courthouse to wait for Neville to be brought out, calling after him as he was led into a sheriff's vehicle. Dostal responded to questions about Neville's financial assets and his ability to be a flight risk.
Our bail system isn't just a cash bail like you see in the TV, like in the US. The amount will be proportionate to one's assets. The most recent release ordered by our court was a case out of Halifax where the order was for about $60,000. And that was only because of the particular financial situation of that individual. And this one, reflecting his greater financial position, it's more than 10 times that amount. What the concern is, and we absolutely share that concern, is that a person who has means and it does travel and does have business affiliations outside of Nova Scotia and outside of Canada could very well be a greater flight risk than just a local individual who stays in the province exclusively. And there's means for that. The ports of entry and in and out of the country require a lot of security clearances, and when it comes to let's say a flight, which is the most likely way that he would, if he were to attempt to leave, to go through, you have to go through CBSA, and we have connections through CBSA, and once we have the draft order, we send it right to them, so they'll be aware immediately. So he wouldn't be able to get to the airport in time before they're aware of his name.
Dostal says within the knowledge of the public prosecution's records over the last 20 years, there's been no amount of bail posted higher than this case. With the bail hearing finished, the case will return to Sydney Provincial Court on October 28th, where Neville will appear in person and is expected to set preliminary hearing dates.
Celebrated local author Leslie Crew's new book, The Spirit of Skatteree, comes out this month. Dialogue's Cora Perrigo spoke with Leslie about how the history of the island inspires her and her advice for others on sharing their own stories.
So what's the inspiration behind Skatteree as the setting?
Well, I've been looking at the island for the last 50 years. We have a cottage in Round Island, and we go out in the canoe, and we just go around the corner, and there it is at the end of in Myra Bay, and I've been there a couple of times, and it just seemed like a interesting place maybe to set a story, because, I mean, there's still people alive today that were born there, and it took me a long time to get this book done, because I was so busy going back into history and wanting to know a lot about it before I even attempted to put the words on a paper, because there's a lot of old fishermen, and I wanted to make sure that I knew what I was talking about. So I talked to a lot of people, and it was great.
So what exactly was the history you were looking into about Skatteree?
Well, Skatteree is it's a tragic island in a lot of ways. I mean, in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century, fishermen from Portugal and Spain and England and the New Indies, came to fish because there was so much fish off its shore. But it's also a really dangerous island because the eastern part, it's like it disappears into the water, the edge of the island. And a lot of, before there was a lighthouse, a lot of boats, would crash into the coast because of storms or fog or, ice. And thousands of people have died, on those shores. And, 1,000 people in 3 wrecks alone. It struck me as like such a sad place in a lot of ways, but everybody here speaks of it with great affection. I mean, the families that had to leave in the 50s because the fishery had changed and there was no need for them to be there, they were all sad leaving, even though, there was only a few, maybe 20, 25 families, but some of them had like 15 kids. But there was a school there and there was a church there and there was even a credit union there. So it had a lot of things going for it, but it was very tough. It was very difficult. Everybody had to bring everything over, coal and animals and, anything that they needed, because sometimes they were locked in the winter and couldn't get out. So I just thought that was kind of like, it's like a way of life that doesn't exist anymore. So I thought it might be a good place to have a story.
So how does your story fit into the history of Skatteree? How has your research kind of informed it?
This is my 17th book. And most of them take place in Cape Breton or sometimes in Montreal, because that's where I'm from. But I've always wanted to talk about the people who live around here. My book, Recipe for Good Life, was about the women in Women's Institute that I sort of grew up with here, and how marvelous they were at making life better for others. And just rural women, who often get ignored, But you want anything done in a community, you ask the 80-year-old in her apron, you know? So I celebrate that kind, celebrate them. And now this book, I want to celebrate the people that lived there, the hardships that they endured, the fun they had, because they all want to speak about being one family over there. But yeah, so I started listening to the stories, and I, like I say, my story, my I want to write stories from here, and I've lived here now for 50 years, and I love the place.
Kind of with that, having written 17 books that most of them take place in Cape Breton, you have a couple of kind of memoir-style books. Have you ever considered, with all of these things you've grown up with in Cape Breton and the research you do into things like Scattery, writing a nonfiction book about Cape Breton?
No, because the nonsense I had to go through just to, you know, figure out Scattery and whatever, I'm not a person who delves into history and real things and whatever. I'd be scared to death to write a nonfiction book. So no, it'll only ever be fiction, because nonfiction would strike me as being homework. And writing fictional stories is like fun. So
what can you tell someone about the spirit of Scattery that maybe doesn't know about the book yet?
Well, it's a lot of people maybe not know that the island is real. And I put the spirit of Scattery because the narrator in the book is a ghost. So because there's so many people died there, and I had so much information, I wanted her to tell the story of the three children who grew up together. They were born on the same night on Christmas Day, 1922. And then we follow them through their lifetimes. And it's the voice of the ghost that is telling us what happened to them. And that was the way I figured how I could do it, because I wasn't sure how I could do it otherwise. And I think they're going to enjoy it, because as the book says, Scattery belongs to the living and the dead. There are a lot of ghost stories out there, and fishermen believe those ghost stories. So, yeah, so I just wanted to pay tribute to that, too.
I know it's not even out yet, but do you have kind of any other area of Cape Breton that's inspiring maybe another novel?
Not yet. I'm sort of going through... I don't know. This was a long book, and now I have to go on a long tour for it, and I haven't been that well, so I don't have the energy to think of another one just yet. But I mean, let's face it, there's wonderful places around here that I could, you know, that I could write about. Well, I'll get to it at some point.
And kind of as a writer, do you have any kind of words of encouragement for any other local authors or someone who's thinking about writing about maybe their upbringing in Cape Breton or the things that inspire them about this island? Do you have kind of any advice?
Yes. I'd say to start with your memories, you know, the things that you remember about your family growing up, the stories your grandmother told you. And you can create a story out of any of that and pay tribute to the people who live here. Everybody's got a story. Everybody. I mean, I hear that constantly. I'm at a signing. Oh, I have a story for you. Well, just if you do, then just put it on paper and don't worry about getting it all straight. Just put all the memories on paper, and you can figure that out later. Everything doesn't have to be perfect. People don't write because they think they have to get it right the first time. Every sentence has to be correct. You need to just write your memories down, and then worry about doing all the other stuff later. Because you just have to write what moves you. The things that are important to you, and just do it. I keep telling this story. I was at a writers in school program where I go in and talk to kids, and of course most of the class could care less that I'm there, just that the teacher's gone, so they're happy. But there's always a couple of kids that lean forward and listening to what I'm saying, and I know that they're the ones that, like to read and things like that. And this little boy named Duncan came up to me and said, "This is your lucky day. I'm a writer, too." So just have to get the ideas down.
You have a book launch coming up in Lewisburg on the 18th, I believe.
Yes, I think it's the 18th. Is that the Lewisburg, and that's it from 6 to 8? Yes, I have that, and then I do the mall the next day, and then I'm doing another launch in Port Morion on Saturday, and then I'm going to Inverness on Sunday in the afternoon. So, yeah, so I'm going to start here and then go to the mainland.
A local group is working to improve spaces for skateboarders and BMX riders in the CBRM. Jacob Postway spoke with the Island Skateboard Association Secretary Robin Young about the group, who recently met with CBRM Council.
So I guess first off, just tell us a little bit about the association, kind of how it was founded and what you guys do.
Yeah, so for the last number of years, we've been advocating for the skateboard and skate park community within Cape Breton. We run various programs currently, such as a monthly Learn to Skate program. In the past, we've done some build projects at the Andrew McKinnon Park. We've consulted with Nudon and Eldoeg to build a skate feature on the grounds at that building. We've collaborated with the Cape Breton Regional Library to get skateboard kits available to borrow. And we've also been working on the skateboard amenity strategy.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about some of those projects and maybe, you know, what you guys would consider like the highlight projects or the biggest projects you guys have worked on.
Yeah, I think we're very proud of the collaboration with the library and bringing skateboarding to communities across the CBRM. People can rent those skateboard kits from any branch for 3 weeks. So it's given people the opportunity to try out a new sport and try out something fun. We're also very proud of the amenity strategy. We think it's going to make a big impact in the future of skate parks within the region. That's basically a document that proves skateboarding's worth as far as the community development, helping people's mental health, providing safe recreation spaces for people of all ages. So yeah, we're very proud of that as well.
Yeah, I definitely want to chat a little bit more about that, you know, kind of what the response has been and you know, from the skateboarding community and people involved in that kind of thing. What have their thoughts been about the association?
Yeah, we've received so much support. It's honestly been a little overwhelming. The amenity strategy has been something that we talked about for years, and then we finally were able to get the funding and take the time to get it done. So it's been a long time coming. And the reason that we're doing it, or the reason that we've done it, was because when we looked at other cities and communities that had success in building new skate spaces, they had gotten this amenity strategy done. And so we could see the value in it. And it really is going to provide a roadmap for the future of skate parks within Cape Breton. But yeah, the response has been fantastic. The support that we received after our council meeting from the councillors during the meeting and from the mayor was amazing. We had friends and members of the skateboard community in the gallery that showed up, which was unbelievable. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Cool. Yeah, and if you could just, you know, tell us a little bit more of the details about that amenity strategy, that'd be great.
The amenity strategy is providing a roadmap for the future of skateboarding on Cape Breton Island. And it's a skateboard amenity strategy, but there's people that use skate parks that use it for various other activities like scootering, BMXing, strider bikes, all sorts. And so at the end of the day, these strategies are working towards creating these spaces for everybody. We received funding from the CBRM Recreation Department and from the Province of Nova Scotia, and done some fundraising on our own to pay for the document. And we worked with Zap Consulting out of Dartmouth to get it made. And so Zap provided a lot of the community planning and kind of the more academic look at it. So the strategy it's a 70-page document, and there's lots of definitions of things within skateboarding and also within like urban architecture that they kind of worked on, and then a lot of like analysing the demographics, where youth populations are, where public transport routes are, etc. So they done a lot of work like that, and then they also put the document together. And then the work that we done for it was speaking to the history of skateboarding, defining some of those terms and some of those different kinds of skate parks and skate spaces, and then also just provided some of the local insight that they wouldn't otherwise have.
Okay. And could you give us kind of an insight into, you know, what the situation is here for people looking to get into this, like what kind of spaces are available, mm-hmm. like what's kind of the situation here for people wanting to get into, you know, these kinds of sports?
So in the CBRM, there are 7 skate parks and skate spaces. Some of those are full-blown skate parks, such as Cox Heath behind County Rink and Andrew McKinnon Park in Sydney. There's also a skate park in North Sydney, Lawrence Mansfield Memorial Skate Park. There's one in New Waterford. We also have a pump track in Whitney Pier, which opened a couple of years ago. And then we have the Dan Taylor Memorial Skate Bowl Skate Park in Glace Bay. And then we have the Skate Dot at Eldoeg here. So there is quite a few different spaces to skateboard and to scooter and whatnot in the CBRM. Each of the parks has a different level of upkeep. And so specifically the Lawrence Mansfield Skate Park and the Andrew McKinnon Skate Park are both in need of major repairs and renovations. And then the other skate parks just need some ongoing maintenance as well as some basic amenities added, which we are currently working on the CBRM Recreation to get those in place.
Okay. And you mentioned earlier, you know, you presented to the CBRM at their recent Committee of the Whole meeting. So tell us a little bit more about that and what came out of that.
Yeah, so we presented our goal with going to council. We didn't have an ask. We really just went to officially present ourselves and introduce ourselves. We've worked with a few different councillors that have skate parks in their districts in the past, but never had the opportunity to speak to council as a whole. And so we went to introduce ourselves to let everyone know that we had worked on the skate amenity strategy and that was something that we now had and we could reference, and also to let them know that we're about to launch a fundraiser to have the Andrew McKinnon Park completely rebuilt. It was very well received. We had some great feedback from councillors and some great questions as well. We were asked about adding skate spots and skate dots to rural communities, so we were able to speak to that, and we had some really great feedback.
And one thing that's coming up next week for council is they're going to be voting on their 5-year capital spending plan, and a chunk of that, of course, is going to be going to recreation, things like that. So are you guys hoping that, you know, you'll be, now that you've talked to them, that they know who you are, that you guys are going to be considered when it comes time to put money in for those kinds of things?
Yes, we definitely hope so. The nice thing about skate parks is, as I've mentioned, it's a versatile place that it's not just skateboarders that use it. It's people, there's youth on strider bikes and scooters and BMX and rollerblades. And so it's a very, it meets a lot of needs for, it's a free to use, accessible outdoor space. It's also great fun to watch people doing these sports as well. So I think it's more than just using the space for a sport. It's using it as part of like entertainment and just like a nice day out type thing. So we're really hoping that council sees value in that and hoping that some of the funding goes towards these parks.
Right. And tell us a little bit about what's coming up next for the association. You mentioned a fundraiser. So just give us kind of a insight in where you guys are going to be going next.
Yeah. So the fundraiser launches on Sunday, this Sunday. And it is a GoFundMe that we're running for a couple of weeks. So you'll see us sharing a lot about that. I've been collecting testimonials from skateboarders and non-skateboarders alike in the community that are in support of the park. We'll also share a bit about the history of the park and the current state of the park as well. And then once that has wrapped up, we'll be going to local businesses to seek some funding through that avenue as well. And we also have a few fun events up our sleeve. We held a barbecue last 2 weeks ago, and that was great fun. And we featured a skateboarding hot dog.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
It was a ton of fun. So we're hoping to do something like that again and have a couple other ideas that we're hoping comes to fruition. So we're taking a very multifaceted approach to the fundraising and kind of thinking outside of the box. So you'll keep up to date on our, we have a newsletter that you can sign up for through our website and through our social medias. And you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram and we're kind of sharing what we're up to there.
I guess we'll keep an eye on what comes next.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This week on The Good Sentence, Paul McDougall talks to Gabrielle Williams of Inganish about her first book, St. Paul Island, The Story of Lighthouses, Shipwrecks, and Lives on the Graveyard of the Gulf.
So why don't we start off with, why don't you give our Coast listeners just a little idea of what your new and first book is about?
It's a history of St. Paul Island and the two lighthouses that were on the island, the people who worked there, the shipwrecks, and just a general overview of everything that went on that island while people still lived there.
And how did you get interested in this topic?
Well, I started working at the St. Paul Island Museum and Lighthouse. I didn't know much about it before I started working there, but I immediately started to learn more about it. And I got really fascinated by all the history, and the board of directors there had an idea that there should be a book written that was a general history that was accessible to everyone of the island, because nothing like that really has existed. And so I decided to take on that project.
That's pretty neat. How long did it take you to, there's a lot of research in your book. How long did it take you from like doing all that and then actually starting, you know, putting the word, typing the words into your word processor or your iPad? We don't say word processor anymore. Nobody knows what those are. But roughly, how long did it take you to do it?
It took me about a year and a half or 2 years altogether.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of really neat and interesting stuff in this book, and I'd like to just maybe zone in on a few things that you could maybe elaborate with and give our listeners a taste for the book, and you know, I'm certain many people will want to read it. But you say in the introduction that St. Paul's Island is actually a very important to the development of Canada from the European explorers in that. And hadn't really thought of it like that myself until I, you know, read your explanation and how you described it. So first off, tell our listeners where St. Paul's Island is. St. Paul Island, and then get elaborate more on its role in those early days of the development of Canada.
Well, St. Paul Island is between Cape Breton Island and Newfoundland, just about 24 kilometers off the coast of Cape Breton. It's almost right in the middle of the Cabot Strait. So the Cabot Strait, you have to go through the strait to get into the Gulf of St. Lawrence and then on to the St. Lawrence River, St. Lawrence Seaway. And that is what made it such an obstacle, because shipping traffic coming from Europe was taking that route in order to get onto the big ports in Quebec City, Montreal, and then even into the Great Lakes through the kind of waterways that they have there.
So the island was a hazard.
Yes, because it's the only obstacle in the Cabot Strait. It is kind of just sticking up out of nowhere. And with the way that the fog is there, and before people had really accurate navigational GPS, things like that, they wouldn't be expecting it. And then before you even knew it was there, oftentimes your boat would be hitting it.
What are the estimates of shipwrecks out there?
Well, I was able to confirm 80 shipwrecks through contemporary sources, mostly newspapers, from the time that the shipwrecks happened. But people think that it's more like 300. People compare it to Sable Island in that way, because for a long time there's nobody on St. Paul Island to keep track of the shipwrecks. Mm-hmm. And then when people would arrive in the spring, once the ice broke up, to kind of survey the wreckage and see if there was anything to salvage, it would all be too jumbled up to really tell what was what, how many ships were there. There was no names or dates, so a lot of that history is kind of unrecorded. But people who have done scuba diving, wreck diving around the island, have said 300, even 340. Somebody I was talking to who was a diver estimated that.
Wow. Not inconsiderable, then.
No.
How many lives lost, then? You know, what do you think?
Well, I've heard from different sources, people who lived on the island, there's about 2,000 bodies buried. And a lot of that would be kind of mass graves of the shipwreck survivors who would wash up. There's only so much good soil on the island, so only so many places you can dig deep enough. And that seems to make sense, given all of the shipwrecks, and then even the casualties just from people living on the island. There's quite a few children who died.
Those were children that would have been born there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So if the whole history of it, it's really fascinating, and let's get into a bit about the development of the lighthouses, of which there were two, one on each kind of point, right?
Yes.
Well, tell us about how they came about. There was a bit of a confusion between Nova Scotia and New Brunswick on who would actually build a lighthouse and things like that when in the early days of trying to figure out how to do this. Just tell our listeners a little bit about that history.
Yes, well, basically, nobody could decide who was going to take responsibility for this island because of its location and because it's not really a desirable piece of land that you would want to claim. So it ended up being split, the financing for the lighthouses, a couple of different ways. At that time, it was still colonial. England was still in charge, so their lighthouse authority, Trinity House, financed some of it. Nova Scotia, I believe Prince Edward Island and New Brunswick all pitched in.
And what time period is this that we're talking about?
This is the 1830s. Mm-hmm. So 1832 is when they first established a human presence on the island in the form of the life-saving crew, which would be a crew of men with boats, shelter, and provisions. And their job was, while the lighthouses were being built, to go out when they saw a shipwreck and get as many people as possible off of that shipwreck to prevent more loss of life.
This notion of the life-saving crews on islands like this, there's a history to that in other places, right?
Yes, that was a pretty common kind of tactic to try to prevent so much loss of life, because the lighthouse keeper would have to kind of stay where he was, keeping the light working, although there's a lot of stories, too, of lighthouse keepers going out on the water and kind of courageously saving people off shipwrecks. But the life-saving crew was their whole purpose. And it was especially important on St. Paul because this was while the lighthouses were being constructed. So at the time when they first were working there, there was nothing to prevent a ship from running into the island. So they were kind of the only defense.
So fog was the big problem.
Fog was the biggest problem. The fog out there, because of the different currents meeting the Labrador and the Gulf Current. I mean, fog is bad here in Northern Cape Breton, but it's really bad by St. Paul.
Yeah. There are dozens, and you've listed them in the book, of lighthouse keepers and with their names and, you know, just a little vignette or something about them all. But they also had families, wives, children born there and that. And then you had the life-saving crew and that. How many people at one time may have actually been living out on St. Paul Island?
So the peak for the population would have been in the 1910s. They had, at that point, the life-saving crew. They would have two light keepers with their families and assistants out on each end of the island. And they had a governor or superintendent and his family. And at that time, they had a lobster cannery on the island that lasted for about 3 summers. And the lobster cannery workers and some of their families were there. So at that time, probably 70 would have been the peak.
Wow. So it's,
but since then, it's not. That was kind of an unusual occurrence.
Right. Now, it certainly wasn't easy to get to the island, like, you know, if you needed to get there in a boat, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us just kind of a description of what the shore and everything is like there and how more or less treacherous it is.
Well, the shore is very much cut into by the waves. It's very jagged and rocky. There are these cliffs that kind of suddenly drop down. It doesn't really have what your picture is beaches or kind of like a soft shoreline easing into the ocean. It's pretty dramatic. And there is really no adequately sheltered harbor for a ship to anchor. The best one is Atlantic Cove. That's where the government supply ship would anchor. But even Atlantic Cove, it's not the best harbor. There's been a lot of wrecks there in Atlantic Cove.
Mm-hmm. Now, one interesting thing you talk about in the book is, when they switched over from oil to kerosene, and there's a Nova Scotia connection there with the kerosene and the lamps and that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the person who discovered kerosene, Dr. Abraham Gesner, I believe his name was a Nova Scotian. And he had visited the island as a young geologist. He had spoken to the superintendent there at the time, John Campbell. And then later he goes on to create this fuel, which ended up being the best fuel that lighthouses use. It burns clean and bright, and it really became the go-to for all lighthouses, including the lighthouses on St. Paul Island.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of other neat things. It was our Marconi wireless station for a while, right?
Yeah. Yes, there was lots of radio operators working there as part of the Marconi wireless.
World War II?
Yes.
What went on there?
World War II, they had the wireless station. I know we have some stories at the museum of some families, some radio operators and families trying to get away or moving off of the island because they were pretty frightened of German U-boats being around there.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a presence on the island all through World War II, and then it wasn't until after in the 50s that the radio station was actually kind of decommissioned.
It lasted till when? The 1990s? Manned or personed?
The lighthouses?
Yeah,
1991 is when the North Lighthouse was automated. So the last lightkeeper left in 1991.
Yeah, and who was that?
That was Paul Cranford.
Yeah, tell us just a little bit about Paul Cranford. I think many of our listeners will know who Paul Cranford is, but they may have forgotten this part of his life.
He was a lighthouse keeper. He came from, I believe, Ontario, and then he ended up being out on the island for quite a number of years. He is also a very accomplished fiddle player. He collects and archives kind of classic fiddle music, and he's written lots of fiddle music as well. So that was kind of a hobby of his while he was working on the island. And he was the last lightkeeper on St. Paul before the North Light was automated. And I believe he went on to be lightkeeper elsewhere in Nova Scotia in the kind of the later, the twilight years of the mm-hmm. lighthouses before automation.
Yeah, he came down here hitchhiking adventure or something, and he was only like early 20s, and the job was advertised, and he wasn't a fiddle player either at that time.
No, it's something he picked up.
Yeah.
It's
pretty interesting story, his.
It is. He's an interesting person for sure. Steamers, icebreakers could pick them up.
So when you just kind of putting the island in perspective then, for, you know, the number of losses of life by ships coming over with Europeans and then hitting the island, crashing, whatever. Some may have made it the island. Hundreds didn't. Like you said, up to 2,000 graves there. But there would have been well into the hundreds of men in particular, the sealers, saved, their lives saved because of St. Paul Island. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, yes, definitely. There was a lot of heroic actions by the people who worked on the island. And there was quite a lot of heroism. I mean, they considered it their job, but it took a lot of personal courage to go out. Often it would be these huge storms and just try to save as many people as possible, which often they succeeded.
Yeah, literally the whole boatload.
Yes, in many cases.
There's the description in the book where you talk about the food that's like put out there in the life-saving station, you know, like, you know, piles and piles of pork or beef and other provisions and that, which are really just, I take it this is all just in barrels being on ice or whatever, in case of these situations, right?
Yes. So the life-saving crews in particular were really stocked up just in the event of these shipwrecks mm-hmm. so that they could theoretically support 100 extra people on the island until another ship to come and pick them up.
Yeah. Truly fascinating. I'm talking to, for our listeners, to Gabrielle Williams. She's a native of Inganish, living now in Salt Harbor. She works in Dingwall at the museum there. And at the museum, you have one of the last remaining lighthouse. You have it there. Tell us a little bit how that lighthouse ended up at the museum.
Yeah. So the St. Paul Island Historical Society that was formed in the early 2000s, community members who wanted to preserve the history of St. Paul Island. And they knew that this Southwest lighthouse had been preserved and that it was at Coast Guard depot in Dartmouth, and their intention was to get it back here to Dingwall, where a lot of the family members of lightkeepers and lightkeepers themselves lived and still live, and where a lot of people in Dingwall and the surrounding areas have a kind of vested interest in the history of the island, a personal connection to it. And so in 2010, they actually got the museum up and running. And then in 2011, that was when the lighthouse itself, the Coast Guard, kind of transferred that to us. So it's a cast iron lighthouse, so it just comes apart in pieces. And they shipped it down to us on an 18-wheeler, and then it was rebuilt on the museum grounds. And now we have it, and anybody who wants to come see it, we can open it up. You can look inside. It's all the original. It's the original lighthouse. We have the Fresnel lens.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. And in your book, you have a number of photos, color photographs, actually, and they're of putting it back together piece by local people.
Yeah, and a lot of that was volunteer as well. Actually, most of the labor, I would say, was volunteer.
Yeah. So the St. Paul Island Museum, located in Dingwall, northern Cape Breton. Are you open every day?
We are closed on Mondays, but okay. Every other day we are open 10 to 5.
10 to 5, okay. So I would encourage any of our listeners, if you're from the area and you've not been there, or if you're visiting and you're listening to Gabrielle Williams and myself talking about St. Paul Island, her book, The Story of Lighthouses, Shipwrecks, and Lives on the Graveyard of the Gulf. Where can people, first off, go check out the museum, go into the lighthouse if you can, and the book, where can we get the book, Gabrielle?
We have copies for sale at the museum and Breton book stands. They're in all sorts of small businesses around Cape Breton. You can check out, and also Breton Books, they're online, their websites and their catalog. You can order from there as well.
Mm-hmm. All of this is, that's all pretty neat stuff. The fascinating seafaring history, but, you know, the perseverance of people that worked out there for all those many years. Some of these people are, of course, many of them are in later years are still alive and around. So it's a great history you've done there, Gabrielle. You should be thanked for it. And why don't you leave us with one good sentence from the book, okay?
The passion for St. Paul Island and its history remains despite the ravages of time, and the very fact that all of its secrets have yet to be unraveled keeps that history alive in our minds and will for years to come.
Cape Breton Eagles hockey team is warning businesses about a scam where people are asking vendors and sponsors for money using the team's name. The manager of the Canadian Hockey League team says some people have been duped after receiving correspondence by the fraudsters. Joey Haddad says they used a staff member's name and a fake email address while offering business deals and promotional partnerships.
I'm hearing certain vendors transferring $150, a couple of those. We had one today. The company actually sent us $195, and we reached out just wondering why they sent us money. And they then backed it up with the email correspondence, and it was just, I don't know if it was due diligence on their part or if they forgot what the email was and they looked it up online and then sent it to info@capebretoneagles.com instead of this scam AOL.
Haddad says one of the targeted businesses even showed up for a meeting at the Eagles head office after an elaborate scheme to convince the victim their proposal was legitimate.
Yesterday, we had two vendors show up for a fake 10 o'clock meeting. That's really where all of this came to light, that there was a scam going on. When they came to the office and said, hey, I'm here for the 10 o'clock vendor meeting. And none of us kind of knew what they were referring to. They showed us some email correspondence. We recognized right away that that's not any of our emails.
Haddad says he wants the business community to know if they see an email with an AOL extension, it should be deleted immediately. And he says the police are investigating.
They're going to keep us informed on an as needed basis. And at the end of the day, all I've expressed to the CBRM police services is that we want to do right by the vendor. So the best way we can support right now is to get a case file open. So if they need to talk with their insurance providers, everything is legit. Everything is an open case right now.
Haddad says technology is advancing and the scammers are getting more and more tools to fool people these days. And many people have been affected in one way or another.
With the technology out there today and everything that's going on in our fast-paced digital technical world, not everybody's caught up to speed on, the tricks of the trade. And unfortunately, these things do happen. I think everybody on an individual basis has some sort of a story where they were fooled or duped or scammed or caught up in an unfortunate situation.
Coast Radio isn't able to connect with any of the affected businesses. Haddad says because of privacy concerns, he can't release any of the names. That's all for Dialogue this week. If you have an idea for a segment on the show, call the newsroom at 902-284-6397 or send an email to news@coastalradio.ca. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.